So just to clarify, do we have questions after the presentation, or
they are? Depending on how many questions are in the middle.
Okay, but can we leave questions for after the presentation if the questions are too?
If the question is too
long,
too involved,
yeah.
You can say yes.
Okay. Okay.
If you can answer briefly, please try to.
Okay. But if you don't ask any questions, it's fine. Okay, so the talk will be mainly a review of a scattering amplitude for massless particles, in particular at the tree level. So why do I care about the tree level? Well, first of all, quite generally, you would expect at high energy levels to neglect the mass. So it's theoretically interesting to consider massless theories. But in particular, we have some nice examples. We have the standard model. We have the strong interaction. So in QCD, the force are mediated by gluons, which are massless gauge bosons of helicity plus or minus one. We also have perturbative gravity, at least at the tree level. At the leading order, we have this graviton scattering, which is a particle of helicity plus or minus two. And this, in the last year, these theories have been shown to exhibit a very rich mathematical structure, which is invisible for the underlying Lagrangian, and which actually help us to understand better the cumbersome computations that you get if you compute all the Feynman diagrams. Here is, in this nicely written table, there is the number of diagrams that you need to compute in order to get the scattering of n gluons. So you can see how that increases even at the tree level. So in particular, I will describe some very nice construction which is related to the graviton and the gluon scattering, and it's called KLT. And if time permits, I will talk a little bit about CHY, but I don't think so.
Well, what does this gluon goes to n minus two? Oh, that's
that diagram. Okay. Yeah, yeah. This is scattering of n gluons. So
okay.
This is the table that gives you how many Feynman diagrams they go with the Catalan numbers. But we try to understand this even without the Feynman diagrams.
Can you explain the green diagram?
Oh, the green diagram is a particular property of some massless on-shell amplitudes. So they factorize. If you take two particles, or if you take a group of particles to be on-shell, then the internal line actually diverges because you have internal propagator here. If you take P4 and P5 to be on shell, P4 plus P5 to be on shell, then the internal line diverges. You have a pole in that point. And what's the residue at that pole is two on shell amplitudes. So I will cover that maybe later. Okay. So just a quick review of SUN. You know what SUN is. It's described by a Young-Mills theory. But all that you need to know here is that you have two kinds of vertexes. So you have the three-point vertex and the four-point vertex. You have some color structure, which is given by a structure constant, some kinematic factor, which depends on the momentum, and it couples to the polarization vectors given for some helicities. The four-point vertex is a little bit more complicated. It has some color structures. Define it in this way. For polarization vector are some kinematic factors. So if you start this, if you start from the Lagrangian, you will see some explicit gauge invariant, right? So that's actually a gauge redundancy that we have in the polarization vectors, and we have to deal with it. And a way to deal with that is actually to choose the polarization vectors in such a way that the four-point vertex won't contribute. So if you compute, for instance, the four-point amplitude, you only need to compute the three-point vertex contribution for certain value of the polarization vectors, and you will add, of course, you will add the three channels. So for each channel, you have some color factor, which I just defined in the previous slide, some kinematic factor, and the propagator of the channel. So you add the three, and you get this. And this color factor satisfies the Jacobi identity, but you see that the kinematic factor and the color factor are in some way in the same footing. They are in some way at the same level. And actually what you can do, and this was very recently discovered, if you keep the 4-point interaction vertex, and then you will get a shift. because in the four-point interaction vector, you have polar structures also. So if you keep that vertex, and then you compute the four-point amplitude, you will get a shift in this kinematic factors. And you can adjust that by requiring that these three kinematic factors actually add up to zero. So there is actually a very explicit duality here between the kinematics and the color, and it's called color kinematics duality. And it was discovered in 2008, and you can actually, it's not yet well understood, so I won't talk about it. But if you want, you can ask me about that later. So here, but I will need just to, I will do a change of basis. So if you write the color factor in that way, then you use the completeness relation of the generators, you will have these four traces, right? It's a trace of four generators. So you can write the amplitude in terms of this basis and these coefficients. In this case, you will get, for instance, these coefficients that depend on the permutation. And the way you compute them is you simply take the permutation here. These are the permutations of the generators. You take the permutation here, and you compute all the planar diagonals. By planar, I mean that you order this in the permutation that's given by this. It's called the partial amplitude. And you just compute the diagrams that you can draw in the plane without crossing the lines. So here you have the S and the U diagram. You don't have the T. And the important part here, the crucial part, is that the poles of this thing are very well defined, are very well determined, and are exactly the poles that you get for two consecutive particles. So here you have a pole for 1, 2, for 2, 3, for 3, 4, which is 1, 2. So that's why you get only S and U. And I will need you to remember that for.
Why is there no T-term?
Oh, the T-term is in the other permutation. So if you actually, if you do the algebra, then you will have to expand the color factors here. Right? So the color factors here, for the T-term, you won't get the 1, 2, 3, 4 permutation. So the 1, 2, 3, 4 is only going to appear in these two. So that's why. And that's the general rule. You will only have to compute the diagrams that you can draw in a plane. And that can be done actually for n particles at the tree level. And it's not only for Young-Mills. It's for any theory that has color. It's called the single trace decomposition of the tree level amplitude. It's very interesting. It has many properties. It's cyclic, of course, because of the cyclicity of the trace, this is going to be cyclic. So you have at most n minus 1 factorial. But it turns out that in 2008, some very nice relations, linear relations, were discovered. And now we know that we have only n minus 3 factorial independent partial amplitude in general. I will need you to remember that. So. Okay, so just a quick review of gravity scattering. I won't say much about this, but you can see that if you start from reaction, you will have some gauge redundancy, so you will have many kinds of interaction. The graviton is a spin 2 particle, so it has helicity plus or minus 2. It's massless. And you can decompose, a very crucial point is that you can decompose the polarization tensor of the graviton as a tensor product of two polarization vectors of photons or of gluons. So you can actually guess, yes, using some helicity properties of the amplitude and some kind of dimensional analysis, you can guess what's the tree level amplitude for the graviton without looking at the Lagrangian, just because of helicity. And it turns out that this, well, if you normalize the couplings, turns out to be exactly the product of the Young-Mills partial amplitude squared. So it's the partial amplitude that you multiply, and you will get the graviton amplitude at the tree level and for three particles. It's kind of weird because here you don't have color. Here you have color. Here you have both symmetry. This is the complete amplitude. Here you don't have both symmetry. It's a partial amplitude. So what would you expect the answer to be for four particles? And it turns out that it's completely non-trivial. For four particles, you will have some weirdly mixed combination of permutations, which are not both symmetric. Here, if you change particles, you change the amplitude. You change the partial amplitude. Here you don't, because this is both symmetric. The S channel, of course, is not both symmetric. So this is a weird and non-trivial answer, but it's correct. So we would like to understand what is this? What does it mean? and what does it mean for n particles at the tree level. And one hint comes from string theory. I'm not going to talk about the string theory itself, but you should know that the graviton arises as the massless state from the closed spring, while the photon and the gluon, if you do it properly, will arise as the massless state for the open spring. So the way you compute amplitudes here is, well, you start from the bosonic spring, so this is 26 dimension, but the construction KLT, which I'm not going to talk about, I will talk about KLT, is going to survive and it's going to survive to the compactification, so it's fine, down to 4 dimensions. So the way you compute amplitudes is you use conformal invariance, so basically you scatter your strings and then you use your conformal invariance such that you're mapping this worksheet into the complex plane. For the closed string, for the open string, you map it to the upper half plane.
Sorry, what is KLT?
KLT stands for Kawhi-Leonard type. It's probably not pronounced that way, but it's KLT. Yeah, it's the three guys that discovered this in '86. I wrote that after this. Yeah, but I cannot explain this one better than KLT the paper, but I will try. Okay, so the way you compute string amplitudes is you insert vertexes. So for the open string, you insert the vertex into the real line, into the boundary of the upper half plane. So you integrate over all the possible positions for insertions. You divide by some Fadeev-Popov determinant because you have SL2C invariance, and you have some integrand. So you have the polarization vectors here for the photon or the gluon. And then you expand this and you take the linear combinations of the polarization vector. So I need to notice here that if you expand this in order to get this quantity at the tree level, the scattering amplitude, you will have to reduce the power of xi minus xj by an integer. And that's important. For the closed string, it's the same story. You will have to integrate over the complex plane, divide by the same determinant. And the integrands here, if you look for the integrands of the scattering, they are actually the exact product between two integrands of the open. So that's a key fact. It's not the complete story, but it's a key fact. So for instance, if you don't have two integrands for three particles, you divide by this determinant. It means you don't integrate the three particles. You fix the three particles. You will see that the amplitude is actually a product because you don't integrate nothing. So you have just a product of integrands as the product of the integrands of the open string. So for the three particles, it's trivial, the fact that you will find, as I explained, you will find the decomposition of the graviton amplitude. But what happens with four? I mean, where does this came from? And so if you have to integrate something here, if you have to integrate something, then you will, for instance, fix the three points because of SL2C invariance, fix it to 0, 1, and infinite, and you are left with this integral. And you are left with actually the same form for the open string. So if you try to integrate this, you will see that you have a seed and seed bar, and they are factorized. Right, so if you integrate seed and seed bar independently, this is actually going to be a fact. It's going to be a product of two open string amplitudes. But you cannot do it because this is formally an integration over the complex plane. This is an integration over x and y. If you integrate x, here you are going to integrate something that's in seed, and it's in seed bar also. So it's kind of a convolution between two integrands. So it's not completely factorized, but so what's the key observation of KLT? You integrate y, so you integrate over the real line in y, you do analytic continuation, and you avoid the branch points. Why you have branch points? Well, this is the integral that happens when you expand the exponentials. Because of this, kinematic variables are not integrals. So you have branch cuts, and you have branch points. So you avoid this, just continuing, just analytically continuing the y integration. And if you continue the y integration, you get real variables for seed and seed bar. So you can actually factorize the integral. So you take this prescription for y, and you take it to be the prescription for eta. So you get this prescription for eta. How do you call this letter?
Sorry.
That, OK. I didn't remember. OK, thanks. So if you have psi less than 0, then what you will find is that the eta contour is actually above the branches. So that's, in that sense, you won't get anything because you can close the contour. Here the same. And here you will get a contribution that's the phase change between, it's the phase change that happens when you turn around the one point. So if you turn around the one point in the eta plane, you will have this phase of difference between the two parts of the branch. So you will get this integral. Only psi between 0 and 1 contributes, and only eta between 1 and infinity, if you take this contour to the other side, only that eta contributes. So now you have complete factorization. And that's actually the key point. And if you look at this, this is not the complete amplitude of the open string. For the open string, you have to integrate. Remember, you have to integrate over all the real plane, all the real line. So this is not the complete amplitude. This is just from 0 to 1. It's actually a beta function. It's the Venetian amplitude. And it's symmetric in S and T. It has a pulse. You know that the beta function has pulse whenever this thing is going to 0. So k1, k2 is S, and k2, k3 is T. Right. So this is a part of the amplitude of the open string that has pole only in S and T. It doesn't have pole in U. And this is a part of this open string amplitude that has poles in T and U. It doesn't have poles in S. So what could that be? Well, if you remember a few slides ago, of course, the partial amplitude is not the complete amplitude. It's just a part of the amplitude that contributes with some of the poles. So this is actually a product of partial string amplitudes, open string amplitudes. It's true for the tachyon. It's true for the first massless state, the graviton, and in this case, the gluon. And it's true for any of the states of the open and closed string. And it's true quite generally for n particles. You will decompose the integrand in this way. And here you will have a phase change that depends on the contour. And you will see that this phase change is constant when the ordering between these variables and these variables and these variables is fixed. So if I fix some ordering of the e variables and the eta variables in the real line, then this integral is factorized so that I will get this nice sum. Not all the terms contribute. You can see it from, if you carefully analyze the integral, you will see that, for instance, this ordering doesn't contribute. But in general, you will find that you will have n minus 3 factorial terms here, n minus 3 factorial terms. And this p is actually the ordering of the partial amplitude that I told you. So what does this mean? The answer is that we don't know. It's highly non-trivial for more than 4 particles. It's extremely, I mean, if it wasn't because of a string theory, this probably wouldn't have been discovered. But now we understand that it's actually a general property of quantum field theories. It can be done for many other theories. It's not a property of gravity nor a property of Young-Mills. So the question is, how general is this and what does it mean? What's the KLT product of two theories? What's the KLT multiplication of amplitudes? It cannot be seen at the Lagrangian level. There have been some modifications of the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian such that it's a bit more explicit, but it's not well understood. And of course, it's not well understood in general. So what's the meaning of KLT in general? So that's it.
Meaning of KLT, if I'm not going to add that.
Yeah, it's very intriguing. I would say that you would expect to find a tensor product, the composition of a theory, such that you would label the states to live in a representation of some symmetry group of the QFP. And if you do the direct product of the tensor product of the representations, you will, in some way, you will find the KLT product. It's an idea, but it's not well understood. Yeah.
Can you explain why there's only n minus 3 factorial?
Okay, so turns out that if you compute this phase, you will find a prescription for the integration over eta for a fixed configuration of chi. So the prescriptions tell you that if chi I is greater than chi, one, chi j, then you will have to integrate eta I over eta j. That's the prescription. You fix chi and you integrate over eta. So for instance, in this case, in this ordering of chi, you will see that this one is greater than all of the other chi's. So the eta that you are going to integrate, the eta k here, is going to be integrated over all the other etas. So you will be able to close the contour because you won't get into a branch. So it's basically not contributing. So the only orders that contribute are when none of the chi's is outside this interval. So they all have to be in the interval between 0 and 1. So you will have to order n minus 3 terms here in the interval 0 and 1, and that's n minus 3 factorial terms that you will get to this.
And does this simplify maybe some calculations, or is it just
It does. It actually does. I mean, it has some computational power. If you see the graviton scattering, if you go to n particles at the tree level, I'm not considering any loop here. You go to n particles, you will have all the interaction vertexes up to this vertex. So that means that you will have to consider all the processes, even more than in Jan-Mills. So if you can write this as a product of two Jan-Mills amplitudes that you actually know how to compute, and there is a closed form, in some particular cases, there is a closed form for the partial amplitudes, it's without computing thousands and thousands of diagrams, you will be able to find the graviton amplitude.
I don't understand at the end. Do you know the closed form for particle kernel?
These amplitudes depend on the elicity of the particle. So here I have color, I have an elicity, and I have moment. For some configurations of the elicity, the partial amplitude is known for n particles. So in that case, it means that for the same configuration of the elicity of gravitons, I have a expression, a closed expression for the free amplitude. So in that way, it's actually quite powerful.
And why can you decompose the polarization as a product of the polarization you have there? Up in the diagram. Second point. Good.
Why can I do this? Oh, this is symmetric if you fix some gauge. I mean, it depends on the gauge, of course. But for instance, if you fix the polarization vectors such that they are transverse to the momenta, this is also transverse, it's symmetric. And If you want it to be traceless, you can do it. So it has all the corresponding properties that you would find, or you will find that this should have according to your gauge. So this and this has the correct elicity also. It's a symmetric tensor, right? So you would expect a symmetric traceless tensor to be describing a particle of a spin two.
If you calculate the open string amplitude, will it give you the same result?
With what?
The same KLT relation? I mean, if you calculate the...
This is a relation between the closed and the open string amplitude. It's basically a relation between these two. Okay. So the point here is that you can write the closed string amplitude for any state, but this is for the massless state, as a product of two open string amplitudes. So that's the key point. I mean, you can write this as a product of two at the integrand. You can write them as a product of two open. If you know how to, I mean, if you want to do the same for the open string, I would guess you have to factor, you have to factorize this in some way, such that each integrand has meaning by itself. And I don't know if that's
true in tree level or
yeah, this is just the tree level discussion.
You don't have cut the py into two halves so and glue them together. So you,
sorry.
I think that's why you get the get factorized.
Yeah. Of course, it's just the most simple process that you have, so you can map it to the Riemann sphere.
So what happens when you go beyond tree level? Can you, your formalism, can you give some generalization?
What happens if you go beyond tree level? I think there's no such thing as KLT or more than tree level. We do have some very nice relations, but for the masses on shell amplitudes at loop level, but not KLT. We have other kinds of structures that it has been discovered, some recursion relations that gave us some clue how to construct the loop amplitudes on shell starting from the tree level amplitudes. But I'm not sure if KLT is understood at that level. Probably no. Okay. Thanks.
So today I'm going to talk about Lee Robinson bounds, which are a theoretical limit to the speed at which we can send information in quantum many-body systems. So just to begin introducing the main concepts to understand what this sentence means, we think of many-body systems as systems where we have many components that interact with each other. And we might think about the atoms interacting in a solid, but also other systems like neurons in the brain, or the companies that interact inside the market, inside the stock market. So in this system, it's very interesting to know whether two different regions are connected to each other or are somehow acting independently because they cannot talk to each other. So in relativistic field theories, we know that the information propagation is bounded by the speed of light. We cannot send any information faster than the speed of light. However, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the situation is less clear, because by taking more and more orders of perturbation, we might have some interaction in long distances in arbitrarily small times. So the question is whether there is a speed limit in many body systems. And that's what the Lee-Robinson bounds are going to tell us. Naively, one intuitive idea is that when we have local interaction, this is each of these particles in a many body system only talks to the particles which are nearby. In this local situation, we might think of a certain speed. For example, if we think of a neuron which emits a signal, this signal will reach the neurons nearby, and then these neurons will re-emit the signal, and that's the way neuronal waves are transmitted in the brain. And there is a certain speed from the moment when the first neuron fires the signal and it reaches another region of the brain. So is this what happened in quantum many-body systems? Well, kind of. So to see what the Lee-Robinson bounds mean, we firstly need to introduce an idea of distance, an idea of time in our quantum mechanics formalism. So to introduce an idea of distance, one thing which is usually done is to set our particles in a lattice, for example, the atoms in the lattice of our material. And we describe the distance between two of these atoms as just the distance measured on the graph. So for example, the distance between these two atoms would be right? So now that we have this description, we can also describe regions on the lattice. We can define the diameter of a region as the maximum distance between atoms contained in a region. So for example, which is the diameter of this region? So we can think about the distance between this atom here and this atom here, for example, and the distance is, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4. For the other region, we also have 4. And we can define the distance between regions as the minimal distance between points of the different of nodes of the different regions. So for example, which is the distance between these two regions? So now we have defined some kind of measurement of like distance in our medieval body system. And we also want to define what locality means, because the locality is based on the interactions of the system. And for that, we need to study the Hamiltonian. So we're going to work with Hamiltonians, which are a sum of operators. And each of these operators is only going to be supported in a certain region of the lattice, and will be their entity elsewhere. So we say that our system is local. If we can describe its Hamiltonian as a sum of operators, what each of these operators is contained, the support of each of these operators is contained in a region of diameter smaller than k. And that's our definition of locality. Now, if we want to explore this idea of sending information, we need to express that in terms of operators. So the idea is that we are studying a system and we have two different regions. In one of these regions, we'll be having a perturbation, an operator 8, which perturbates our system, is acting there. And we'll be looking in a different region where we'll be measuring. And we want to know whether what we measure depends on the perturbation we have in different region or not. And to measure that, we use the commutator between both operators. So if the commutator is 0, that means that what I measure with B doesn't matter whether I perturbate before or later. So I'm not measuring any effect. And that's, so if the commutator is 0, I'm not measuring anything. And the bigger this commutator is in terms of norm, the more likely am I to measure something, to measure a perturbation. And we're interested in seeing that in time, to see how this perturbation travels in time in the system, and when I will be able to measure it.
Sorry, can I have, sorry. What does it mean if the commutator is bigger? In what sense is bigger?
I take the norm of the operator. Okay. Yeah. I take the commutator between A and B, mm-hmm. and I take the norm. And that's an escalar. So to describe the evolution of expected values in time, I take the expected value of the operator. And we might think of the Schrodinger picture, where we have our operator A, which is the observable, which is fixed, is static, and it is the state which is evolving in time. And by evolving in time, the state, I'm measuring it on time. But for our purpose, it would be more useful to work in the Heisenberg picture, where our state is fixed. It is, for example, the ground state of the system, and it is the observable which is evolving. And basically, what I do is I define a new operator, which is like a family of operators, as a function of time. That includes the time of evolution. So now that we have a notion of distance and time, we can state the Lie-Robinson bounds. And what they say is that if I have two operators, A and B, to support is X and Y, and they are disjoint, then if I have a local Hamiltonian, it is true that there exists a finite velocity V, an exponentially decaying function G. So that the norm of this commutator, like the B, which is perturbating the system, and A, which is measuring in time, is smaller than exponentially decreasing, is smaller than this exponentially decreasing quantity, for every time smaller than this quantity, which is just the quotient between the initial distance between the support of these operators and the velocity. So just to think about what this means, what we are seeing is that this is defined in a causal region. So what we have is that for every time smaller than this quantity, it's not possible to measure anything which is bigger than a quantity which is exponentially small. And it's very unlikely to measure. And if I want to measure a correlation, like a commutator between those two operators, which is meaningful, I need to would wait until a time bigger than this quantity. And this defines this causal cone, which is not where I have some exponentially decaying region outside the cone, which is given by this dj. So what I mean is that if I have these two operators, and B is the perturbation, and A is the evolution in time, for time equals to zero, these two operators don't see each other. They're acting in regions which are disjoint. But as time evolves, this operator will be seeing more and more regions of the system. And at a certain time, L over V, this causal region will overlap the perturbation and will be able to measure it. And that's what Lee Robinson bound says. The reason why I introduced it, yeah.
So why is the bound not symmetric with respect to x and y, the size of x and y?
Yeah, it's actually symmetric. You cannot show, I mean, I'm giving the image of I perturbate something which is static, and I measure in time. But you can also think of the opposite situation. And you can fix your measurement and evolve in time your perturbation. And it's exactly the same. You just need to change x by y, and the evolution of b is a function of a, but mathematically it's the same. I'm just trying to give this idea because I think it's easier to see. Yeah, but the math is the same, whether you think of one situation or the other. It's completely analog. Yeah?
Maybe this is a silly question, but this norm is defined for all the states, right?
So the norm of the operator is like the. There are several things to define the norm operator, but one way to do it is to take all the states with norm one. You take the image and take the norm, and the maximum norm you get is the norm of the operator.
Okay, but is there maybe a different kind of a bound for some particular subset of states, quantum states? You know, if you wanted to just look at ground
state, particular quantum. Yeah, in this case, it's general. It's for any state. Later, I will talk about the ground state. Later, I will talk about the ground state, for example, which has some properties. Okay. So the reason why so at this point, Lee Robinson bounds were introduced in 72, and there was a nice. It was for us a very restricted case. Now we have this proof in 2006 from Hastings and Comma, which was general for any dimension. And it has had a high impact in quantum matter theory, mainly for two main reasons. One, because it is experimentally easy, and also because these bounds are the key element of many proofs that couldn't be solved before. So just to give an example of experimental observations, I mean, I don't know too much about the experiment. Yeah.
Do you know any condition or case in which we will actually reach the quantum?
That's a good question. Yeah. So in this experiment, for example, they get a value which is obviously smaller than the bound, but they don't reach it. I don't know if there is a certain condition to reach this. So basically, just to give an idea, what I did was to take a bosonic gas, and they trap it in an optical lattice, so that you have this periodic distribution of the atoms, and they let the system reach the equilibrium. At some point, they quench these lattice, so they have some out of equilibrium situation with excitations which are being propagated in time, and they just measure this excitation for different distances. So what they get is that, so here they are plotting the different distances and the time at which they observe the excitation, and you see that this excitation travels in time. So this is the distance, this is time. And if you fix, like if you plot the value, time versus distance, they get values which are smaller than the Robinson bound. However, it is also very important because there are many results, like theoretical results, were conjectures until 10 years ago and are now proofs because the Robinson bounds were the key element of the proof. And I would just like to give a couple of examples of it. I don't want to bother you with the math, but I think it's it's useful to see the math which is behind this chiral of this fruit. So the first result is that if I'm interested in the temporal evolution of this operator, I can restrict myself to another operator whose support is extremely contained in a certain ball. And the error I'm making is exponentially small. So this is the time evolution of my operator, and I'm just going to restrict myself to this ball, which is defined as this. So this ball obviously increases in time. And we want to see that the mistake I'm making, like the error I'm making by neglecting the actuation of the operator outside the ball, is exponentially small. So to prove this result, sorry for that, we need to introduce the hash method. So basically, we're going to work with topological groups. We say that a group is topological if we can define a topology that makes continuous the internal operations of the group, which are like the product and the inversion. And if this topology is locally compact and Hausdorff, we say that the group is a topological group. A Hausdorff measure in a topological group is a measure which is invariant the measure of a subgroup is invariant if I just measure the subgroup, or I multiply all the subgroup by one element of the group, the measurement doesn't change. And one classical result is that of functional analysis is that every locally compact group accepts a Hausdorff measure, and it is unique except for a multiplication by a constant. And indeed, if the group is compact, this measurement will be finite. So we can choose this constant so that the measurement of the group is one, like the total measurement is one. So it's just a mathematical tool. But the idea we're going to do is basically restrict ourselves to the ball and trace out whatever is out. And the way to do that is to define an additional operator, which is built like this, which is basically the integration of an operator over all the unitary operators whose support is outside the ball. If you are not used to thinking about these things in an integral way, you can think, we can use the Schur's lemma to see that this integral actually commutes with the representation. So it is proportional to the identity. And basically what we are doing is exactly that idea of tracing out whatever is outside the ball and just restricting ourselves what is inside. So this operator will, like this, where we are integrating outside the ball, acts as the identity outside. And what the Lyrosum bound says is that if you take the difference in norm between these two operators, then you can express that as a commutator inside the integral. This commutator can be bounded by the Lyrosum bounds, as we saw before. We can take this bound outside the integral. The total measurement is one, so we have a constant, and we get the exponentially decaying error we were looking for. Yeah.
Why do you only integrate over the unitary operators?
It's enough to prove the result. So the good thing about unitary operators is that they form a topological group. If you take the topological representation you take the matrix representation, you take the topology inherited from the complex numbers, and they are a topological group, and they are indeed compact. So you can work with that and define a Hausdorff measure with that. Yeah. So
would you have problems if you had like non-compact group of? If you extended it to more edges?
I mean, I'm just using what I need to prove the result. Of course, you would have problems because then you cannot say that this integration is one. Because if it is not compact, it's not bounded. Okay. I mean, I didn't want to pay more attention to the math, but just an example. The second result, which is also very interesting, is that in spectral in-gap systems, the correlations between two regions of our system for the ground state decays exponentially with the distance between them. And this result is it was a conjecture for a very long time, and it's thanks to the Lyrosum bounds that it could be proved. So the idea of knowing, just to introduce what a gap system means, is that you can think you have a finite system, and which is described in a lattice, and you have some eigenvalues for this finite system. As the system increases, you will have more eigenvalues. And the question is, what happens with the separation between the ground state and the first excited state as the size of your system goes to infinite? So if this distance it goes to zero, you have that the system is gapless. And when there is a finite system, so that for every size bigger than one, bigger than a certain one, you have always this separation, you will say that your system is gapless. And what this theorem says is that whenever you have a local quantum system, which is gap, and the ground state is unique, then the correlations between two regions, x and y, which are separated, exponentially decreases with the distance between the two regions. So to think about that, you may think that if the ground state was a product state, this quantity will always be zero. You don't have any correlation between the system. But in this kind of gap systems, your ground state is always is not a product state, so you have correlation. And what this says is that the farther you go, I mean, if you compare the correlation between two regions, the farther you go, the less correlated they are. And it's an important result in quantum matter. So again, the idea to prove it, I don't want to go into details, is that is to use the Lorentz bounds. And it is very remarkable because, as you see, this result only describes the static behavior of the system. There is no time involved in here. So the key to prove this was to go to the evolution of the system and work with the Lorentz bounds, which is not trivial at all. Like, why would you need to evolve your system to get a result about the static, about the static situation? But that's the way it was proved. So the idea was to define a new operator, which is the integration of the evolution of the temporal evolution of B, weighted by a certain Gaussian decaying function. And that allows you to describe this quantity as a commutator between A and this new B. And for time smaller than, I mean, for times inside this causal cone, you can use your Lie-Bronson bounds, because one of the hypotheses is that the system is local. And outside this causal cone, you can use exponentially decaying tail to bound what is left. And you, in both cases, you get an exponentially decaying quantity. And again, this was also measured. This is a Nature paper from 2014. So where they were exploring precisely the idea of how correlations happen in many body systems, and in particular, what happens when the interaction is not local. So the experimental setup is somehow similar, not the same. They also have a bosonic called atomic gas trapped in an optical lattice. And the main difference here is that they could tune the interactions between the atoms. So they could choose to have first neighbor interaction, like local interaction, but also very long-range interaction, where they break the hypothesis of locality. So the idea is the same. They bring the system out of equilibrium by applying an optical force. And they observe the correlations between different regions. And the result they get is, first of all, when they plot, so what they are plotting here is the correlation function. So the correlations of the system as a function of the separation between the positions they are comparing, and also as a function of time. So if you choose a time, you see that the more separated the ions are, the less correlated they are, which is in agreement with this idea of exponential decay of correlations. But also, they are having it in time. So if they compare one correlation and see how it is transmitted in time in this system, they can find a velocity. And what they found is that for a certain setup of the parameters, when they didn't have local interaction but long-range interaction, which is the interesting case in the situation, because the hypothesis of locality breaks, what they get is that if they plot the velocity and they compare it to the Lie-Bronson bound, there's a certain point where they get velocities bigger than this bound. So they are breaking the result because they are breaking the hypothesis. So this tells us that the hypothesis of locality is not only nice, but also necessary. So just to summarize the main ideas of what we've seen that in local system, we have some Lie-Bronson bounds. which is a theoretical limit for the speed at which we propagate information in quantum systems. And using that, we can prove, for example, that we can approximate our operators by operators which are only locally supported. And we can also prove that for gap systems, this is systems where we have a spectral separation between the ground state and the first excited state, the correlations decay with the distance. Thank you for your attention.
I'm not sure really what all the assumptions are in the derivation of the bond, but could you maybe this use this also in the momentum space? Like, you're not looking at localized operators in position space, but in momentum space. Could you apply this maybe to condensed matter systems where you have, you're looking at the momentum space and you're looking how something in this part of the space is influencing something else in another part? I mean, could you use that also? Could you use this bond in that?
The truth is that I'm not sure. But did you mention that which are the hypotheses? Like, the only hypothesis we have is that our system is local, and definition of locality, as it is usually used in this proof, is based on the space momentum. Whether the result could also be applied in the momentum space, I'm not sure. That's a very interesting question. Thank you.
So you define the locality in terms of some parameter k, right? Like, what's like the size of the... Does that parameter come into the bound? I don't remember.
So I did it a bit. I define locality with in terms of this parameter because it's more intuitive. But if you go through the proof, the hypothesis of locality is introduced in a very strange way. So you can give several definitions of locality, and you get the same bounds. But the thing is that how you define locality is not unique. You can give several definitions. So I prefer not to focus on that. I just said it was local, but we can see it later if you want. Yeah, but there is not a unique way to define locality. And indeed, the way it is used to prove this is not the way I introduced it. But I thought it was more intuitive.
Yeah, so hello everyone, I'm going to talk about multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, also known as MERA, for lattice systems and QFDs, so MERA and CMERA. I'm going to start with a little introduction on tensor networks, what are tensor networks, and why are tensor networks. Then I'm going to talk about the tree tensor network, an introduction to MERA, and then a different view on MERA, namely MERA as a quantum circuit. And at the end, hopefully, I'm going to say a few words about how to make all of this continuous. So tensor networks. Tensor networks first came up in the context of quantum many-body systems. Take, for example, a lattice with n sites. Then there is a certain Hilbert space associated with every lattice point. And the total Hilbert space is just the tensor product of all of these individual Hilbert spaces. The dimension of your total Hilbert space is then written like this, which, as you can see, is exponential in the number of lattice sites. This is disastrous when you want to do computational things. For example, suppose we have a spin 1/2, a spin lattice system with spin 1/2 particles, with, say, 16 on 16 sites, suppose we have a wave function and we want to put it in a computer and save it in a computer, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to write that wave function in the basis, and then what we have to store are all of these complex numbers. So suppose that we have spin 1/2 system with 16 on 16 spins, like this. Then the number of complex numbers we have to store is roughly 10 to the power 80 or something. This is, of course, a horrible number. As a matter of fact, so suppose you would have a classical computer with the amazing technology that you could store a classical bit in every single atom, then your hard drive would have to be roughly, would have to contain roughly every single atom in the observable universe in order to store this one wave function. So it's slightly impractical to build a computer like that, and hence people tried different ways. And that's where tensor networks come in. So a tensor network is basically a way to associate two certain wave functions in your Hilbert space a set of variables. So it's a structure. Usually they make pretty drawings with that. Basically it's a function from CR, with R the number of variables, to your Hilbert space. So we have a certain Hilbert space here, and we want to represent a part of that Hilbert space. We can only represent part of it because, if we represent the entire Hilbert space, we need that many variables again. Now, what we want to do is we want to represent the right part of the Hilbert space, namely a part that is interesting for us, which is usually low-lying energy states, so the ground state and the first excited states. So we want to map to that region. So that's the idea behind the tensor network. An extra small thing, standard notation for a tensor network. There are two things you need to know. One is that we have these circles with a bunch of legs. This thing is just a tensor with three indices. And then what we can do is we can multiply tensors like this. And then the legs that are contracted here means that in your tensor multiplication, you are contracting over those indices.
What does this thing with three legs represent mathematically?
It's just a tensor with three legs, like a matrix, but in three dimensions instead of two.
And are you gonna relate it back to the original problem of storing a large number of these signals?
Well, let's get to that in the next in the rest of the presentation. So you're gonna build a certain, this is just a way to make pretty drawings with the idea of a certain tensor network. And then once you have a tensor network, that gives you a way to associate to a bunch of numbers a wave function. But it depends on the specific tensor network. Yeah?
So just to confirm, this is around three tensor, right? The one with the three.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, is there something like a three-dimensional matrix? Right?
Yeah, I mean, like a matrix is kind of like it. Just think of it as an n-dimensional matrix.
Yeah, but that analogy worries me because it's not a matrix in the sense that there are three tensors. Matrix are like need two components, two indices, right?
Yeah, so that's what I mean. A matrix is like a two-dimensional object, and I'm talking about n-dimensional object. So it has rows, columns, and whatever in the third direction here. So the tree tensor network. A tree tensor network is a tensor network which basically comes from the idea of Wilsonian block spin renormalization. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a ground state, and we're going to take two spins together into one spin in the entire state, and then we're going to do that again and again and again. The pretty drawing that belongs to that thing is like this. So that's basically where the idea comes from. You have a certain, so you want your wave function to be represented by a diagram like this. So now each one of these triangles is a tensor with three indices. So it contains a bunch of numbers, and hence with that many numbers, I can associate a wave function here. Something else that's important to note here is that these triangles have a condition on them, being that they have to be isometries, which is written like this. Here they have three legs. They can have two legs. It doesn't really matter. What this means is basically that...
This one has three legs or four?
Yeah, it has four legs, yeah. I meant three down. So you have a triangle with a number of legs, and if you contract all of the ones down, with the same object but turned upside down. So basically that thing represents a certain tensor, and the condition there is saying that W dagger W is identity. Suppose we want to use this tensor network then to represent, for example, our ground state, then we're going to run into certain problems. The basic problem comes from this. So each one of these legs represents an index which runs from 1, 2, 3, and so on till chi, a certain parameter chi. Now, if chi is huge, then we can represent our entire Hilbert space. But we don't want that, because that would mean that we need to represent a huge number. We need to store a huge number of complex variables again. And that's exactly what made it intractable in the first place. So we want chi to be small. Now, suppose like for our ground state, what's going to happen is that there's going to be entanglement at all scales between all spins. So for example, this spin is going to be entangled with this spin. Now, if you take them together into separate spins, then that means that at this level, that information of them being entangled still has to be stored. Like, the system still has to know that. And if you go to higher scales and higher scales, this keeps being true. But there's more and more spins which send information to the same one. So basically, you're going to get in trouble there. My point being that if you take a small chi here, the kind of wave functions that you're going to represent are not going to have entanglement on all length scales between all spins. Like, these two are going to relate to each other in a very different way than these two are. So that's a problem. And the solution to that problem is what we call MERA. So what you're going to do is you're going to take, again, the idea of Wilsonian block spin renormalization, but you're going to change it slightly to something called entanglement renormalization, which you basically do by adding some boxes. So you have, again, these triangles from Wilsonian block spin renormalization, but now you add an extra layer of these squares every time. And what they do is, seen from the bottom up, they basically take away entanglement between these two. So this one takes away entanglement between these two legs, right? So you have two spins which are entangled, and you apply a unitary to that Hilbert space which disentangles them. And then you can take these two spins, which are now not entangled anymore, and take them together into separate spins. So the problem of entanglement running away to all scales is solved now. Or seen from the top down, you can create entanglement at all scales between all spins now, without having to put all of the information on the top, which is not possible. So this is the tensor network called MERA. Now, why does this work? So as I said, we have a Hilbert space, and we want to represent a small area of that containing low-lying energy states of local Hamiltonians. So in order to do this, what you have to check is that there are certain specific properties that these states have, and generic states in your Hilbert space don't, and then see that MERA has them as well. This specific property here is what's called an area law. So what we're going to look at is entanglement entropy. So you take your lattice, and you take a certain subregion of that, and then you take a look at what the entanglement entropy is between that region and the rest of the lattice. So first, for a generic state, what happens is that the entanglement between two spins is like independent of their distance. It's just a random configuration. So that means that by adding a spin to your region, you have basically a constant contribution to the entanglement entropy, independent of what spin you're adding, which means that you're going to get a volume law. So the entanglement entropy is going to be proportional to the volume of the region A. What people found is that for these low-lying energy states of local Hamiltonians, there's not a volume law, but there's an area law. So it goes proportional to the area. And people can show that for a Mera tensor network with small chi, this is also the case. Another thing worth noting is that Mera is especially good for critical systems, because critical systems have the property that two-point correlation functions decay algebraically, which Mera states also have. So generically, people use Mera mostly for critical systems. Okay, now a slightly different way of looking at Mera comes from.
Can you give an example of a critical system?
A bit louder.
Please can you give an example of a critical system?
A massless boson, massless Klein-Gordon boson is a critical system. It's a scale invariant system. So now a slightly different view on Mera, coming from the quantum information corner, basically looking at Mera as a quantum circuit. So what we're going to do is, so we had these triangles before, these isometries, and what we're going to do now is we're going to write them as a unitary thing with an extra leg, as a unitary tensor with four inches, and then we're going to contract this with a zero state. So basically what happens in the renormalization view is that you have this, and then you project out this part. However, if you keep it there and just put it on top of the picture, what you get is something like this. So in the renormalization picture, we look at everything from the bottom up. So you take the ground state, you take away entanglement at small scales, then you rescale so that you're working on higher scales, and you keep doing the same thing. What we do in the quantum circuit interpretation is the exact opposite. So we start with a product state where every spin is up, say. And then we create entanglement at large distances, zoom in, create entanglement, and keep going like that. So we can look at each one of these layers right under the blue line each time as a new wave function. So all of these, the green one and the two blue ones, together, they're basically just a unitary thing. Working on that state, creating a new wave function, let's say psi 1. And then you do that again, and you do that again, until in the end you end up with the ground state of your system. This is a very nice way of looking at things, particularly when you're interested in C-Mera, because of what I'll tell you in the next slides.
Can you go back? What do the legs going off the side of the diagram?
So you have a problem when you want to write this down, which people basically solve by making it periodic usually. So there's a leg. This box is actually the same one as there. So in C-Mera. So C-Mera, the goal of C-Mera is to try and generalize Mera to QFTs, to apply it to quantum field theories instead of lattice systems. And specifically, one of the things it would be good for is to create an IR and UV regularization scheme that doesn't break unitarity, that doesn't break all of the or any of the physical principles of your system, any of the symmetries. So in QFT, we saw two regularization schemes so far. One is the sharp momentum cutoff, and that gives you something which is not unitary anymore. Another one is to put everything on a lattice, which breaks all of the continuous spacetime symmetries. And C-Mera would not do that. So that's one reason to look at this. Another reason is that people are hoping to do non-perturbative calculations in QFDs by using this eventually. Okay, so we go back to the quantum information view of Mera, and we try to apply that to a QFD. So we had a discrete space and a discrete extra dimension, like a scale. And now what we want to do is we want to make both of them continuous. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to apply it to a QFD. So all of the states now are now like states in a different in the QFD Hilbert space instead of on a lattice. And then we're going to try and take the number of steps that we take, the number of layers, take that to infinity and make that a continuum. So in order to do that, you need three things. The first thing you do is you start at the top. You need a product state. Then what you're going to do is, so you have the product state. Then you're going to apply a unitary, which creates entanglement on large distances on small momenta. It's going to entangle these small momentum modes, which looks something like this. And then here, eventually, epsilon is going to be taken to 0, and then the number of steps to infinity to make it into a continuum. K here is the entangler. It's the operator which creates that entanglement, and it depends on S, where S is the scale. So we had a discrete number of layers before, and now we're going to a continuum. That continuum has some parameter, which is called scale. And then the third thing you have to do is zoom in, which you do by using a dilation operator. So what you're going to do is you're going to take the product state, you apply the entangler, you zoom in, apply the entangler, zoom in, and you keep doing this. And if you keep doing this, you end up with a state like this. So this is the CMERA analog of the psi i's that I was talking about before. Like you take a product state, you apply a unitary layer, and you get a psi 1, psi 2, and so on until you get to the ground state of your lattice system. Here, there's a continuum of those labeled by the parameter S. This weird P here, by the way, is called scale ordering, sometimes noted by other letters as well, which is the exact opposite of time ordering. So time ordering is going to put low times to the right and high times to the left. Scale ordering does the exact opposite, so that you're creating entanglement at large scales first, and then zoom in and keep going like that. Now, what we want to do is we want to choose this operator K in such a way that so it's going to entangle the modes at large distances in a certain way. And we're going to choose K in such a way that it makes those scales look as much as possible like the QFD ground state. So basically what happens is in here, we have entangled all the modes up to a certain momentum or a certain distance to make them look like the QFD ground state, which means the following. For small momenta, your wave function basically looks like the QFD ground state, whereas for large momenta, you didn't do anything yet. The KS doesn't work on small scales, on large momenta. So for large momenta, you're going to get this. And that's why this is this would be a UV regularization scheme. I think my time is pretty much up. So the only thing worth mentioning here also is that there's a nice way of finding product states and of finding the dilation operator, of fixing that. For the operator K, however, there's a nice way of doing this for free theories, but people haven't figured out yet how to do that for interacting theories. It's still a very recent field, and we're trying to figure out how to do that. Thanks for your attention, and I hope you have learned something.
So when you go to CMERA, you're going to have again
these, it's going to be important, right? How are the scaling relation for the entanglement entropy?
How are?
Like, how would the entanglement entropy scales when you consider different regions? Like, because you don't have any more, you don't have a lattice now,
yes.
Right? You have something at
yes.
the team.
Yes.
And it's of importance, I don't know, it is of importance that depending on the topology of the region that you consider, like if it's a circle, it's going to be different as it has, it's a square that has edges, there are corrections to the scaling law, like logarithmic corrections. So I don't know if that it's important. How are you going to build those boxes now that entangle things?
Wait, what do you mean? Are you talking about Mera or C-Mera?
Like, how the scaling relation for entanglement entropy will enter now in C-Mera?
So the thing is, okay, so if you look at a lattice, then what people found is that for local interactions, which you also have for QFDs, that this entanglement entropy obeys an area law if you're in a low energy state. Now the thing is, if you go from a lattice to a continuum, then basically in building your Hilbert space for a QFD, you're throwing away all high energy states. Because a generic state on a lattice, if you take a limit to like with your lattice size going to zero, that's you basically that energy is infinity.
Yeah.
Like it has an infinite energy density, so those states you just throw out. So the states that remain in there are all low energy states. So they're all going to obey an area law. So basically, you can build a C-Mera for any state. It's just that you need, it's handy to do it for a ground state because you have a nice condition to say which one's the ground state, namely by saying that the energy is minimized.
Same thing again.